Lecture 8, Technology, Positive Externalities, and Public Goods.
In a market which is perfectly competitive, a free and open market, there may not be very much research and development or very much innovation. Now, why is that exactly? The reason economists have come up with is that in a perfectly free market, and I mean a perfectly free market, you're in kind of a heads-I-win, tails-you-lose situation when you think about innovation or competition. Consider for a moment the situation if you're running a business and you're thinking about investing a lot of money in some new innovation R&D kind of project. You put a lot of money into that project. Let's say it fails. Well, if it fails, then you're out a lot of money. Your competitors didn't spend all that money, and you're in very bad shape. You won't be able to keep up with the competition. But now let's imagine you put a lot of money into research and development, and it succeeds. Well, in a perfectly free market, with no particular rules or limits on what other firms can do, other firms now can simply steal your innovation. They can just copy it. And if they just copy it, they didn't have to pay all the costs of developing it and building it up. As a result, you now have exactly the same innovation everybody else has, but you're the one who paid all the money for getting it in place. As a result, you're still worse off than the competition. You're still going to have a hard time keeping up. It's heads I win, tails you lose. Businesses don't invest unless they're going to get some money back. They need to get some use out of it. They need to have some ownership of something. Otherwise, if they just put money into something, we would call it charity rather than investment. Thomas Edison, perhaps America's most famous inventor, his very first invention was an automatic vote counting machine. When he discovered, however, that he had this nice automatic vote counting machine, but no one bought it. And so he was unable to make any money from the invention, and Edison's quoted as saying that from then on, he only made things that he knew people would want to buy. If you're going to be a business, if you're going to run a for-profit operation, if you're going to invest money in research and development, it has to be because you expect to make a return. Now, to avoid this problem of people copying all the successful innovations, we have some laws that have been in place for a long time. For example, we have patent laws. Under the patent laws, you have the right to produce your product locked up for a certain period of time. That period of time is moving around for some different products right now, but it's 14 years or 17 years for different kinds of products. Now, the idea is, of course, that if you produce that product for 14 years without competition, then you're able to earn extra money over that time, and that will guarantee that you can get a return on your investment. If you have a patent, you're also allowed to license the product. That is, other people can pay you to use the patent and produce the product. But either way, the idea is to avoid free copying of successful inventions. Another type of law which helps prevent the theft of successful inventions is copyright law. Copyright law typically applies to images, pictures, or text rather than mechanical inventions, but a lot of software, if you think about it, really is images, pictures, text in one way or another. And so software copyright protection locks up that kind of thing for a certain period of time. Copyright law applies to a lot of things that people are not always very aware of. For example, famous images in U.S. popular culture, like Uncle Sam or like Santa Claus, were invented by a person. They were invented by the cartoonist Thomas Nast around the turn of the century. Under modern copyright law, if those images were invented today, they would be like Mickey Mouse. You wouldn't be allowed to use them unless you paid to Thomas Nast, the inventor, the creator of the image. Another thing which is often under copyright that people don't know much about is the song Happy Birthday, which is still technically under copyright. In fact, you may have noticed in the last few years, it used to be that a few years back, a lot of restaurants sang Happy Birthday to people when they were having dinner or something like that. Now, many restaurants don't actually sing Happy Birthday. They sing some little Happy Birthday type song that they kind of made up. Why did they do that? They did that because the people who owned the copyright to Happy Birthday started enforcing it. If you're going to sing a song in a place of business as part of your business, without paying compensation to the copyright owner, you're in trouble. So enforcing the Happy Birthday copyright is part of what changed that for all those restaurants. So the idea of patent law, the idea of copyright law, is to lock something up, to lock it up in such a way that it can't easily be copied by other people. This has been a problem for a long, long time. One of the most famous examples of a famous invention where the inventor got very little was the invention of the cotton gin by Eli Whitney. The gin, of course, is something for separating seeds out of cotton, and it was really important to the growth of the cotton industry in the American South. Well, Eli Whitney was a northerner, and when he invented the cotton gin, he rapidly discovered that when he was down in a southern court trying to enforce his patent on the cotton gin, that the southern courts tended to say, sorry, you don't get any money from us. We're not going to have some southerner have to pay a northerner just because he's got a patent on this machine. You know, the machine is great, we're using it, and we're not enforcing your patent. Whitney was later quoted as saying that there are times when an invention can be so valuable as to deprive its inventor of any money at all. Eventually, some of those cases were settled. Whitney did get a little bit of money. But over and over, there's a problem that when you invent something, other people use it and benefit from it, and you'd only get a small portion of that benefit. Or your invention may open up the possibility for them of inventing or doing something different that they hadn't thought of before. But their new invention may be a little different from yours. So while they built on your invention and they gained from it in that way, they didn't duplicate it in a way which you could enforce your patent rights. The estimates these days are that if you look at a new invention and you think about how much benefit does it provide to society, for every dollar of benefit provided by the new invention, the actual inventor receives only 30 or 40 cents out of that dollar. And that's even with patent law in place, even with copyright protection in place. So those sorts of protections are only letting inventors get a portion, perhaps a third of what society benefits from their inventions. Now this is a problem. It's a problem, and it's a problem called positive externality. This positive externality is just the obverse side of the negative externalities we talked about in the previous lecture about pollution. Instead of pollution, which is a situation where you're imposing social costs on others while not paying for those costs, the issue of technology and new invention is a question of whether a businessman or a firm is providing benefits to others, but while providing those benefits to others is not receiving the benefits back, is not being paid for those benefits they receive. Effectively, it's as if every time a new inventor invents something, we say, well, good for you for inventing whatever it is. You get 30 cents on the dollar, and the rest of it, hey, that's a charitable donation on your part. Now, any time you set up that kind of a system, where if someone does something, they receive only 30 or 40 cents on a dollar, you're going to discourage them from doing that action. In the previous example, in the previous lecture about negative externalities, we were in a situation where there were social costs that were greater than private costs. In other words, businesses were taking their private cost into account, but they weren't looking at the broader social cost because it didn't matter to them. In this situation, businesses, we would say, look at only their own private benefit. They only look at how much money they make as a business. They don't look at whether the broader invention might benefit other sectors of society in other ways. And because they don't take the social benefit into account, they would not be taking into account the benefits that their investments could provide. To give you an example of positive and negative externalities, it's useful perhaps to think about my parents' home back in Minnesota. My parents have a nice older home in a fairly recent suburb. And it's, I don't know, the house must be 50 years old now, something like that. Our next door neighbors, up until a few years ago, were just big time gardeners. They had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful flower garden that stretched out through the front of their house, beautiful blooms, beautiful scent, beautiful appearance. Meanwhile, my parents' house has a white picket fence around it that my father insists on putting in with wood rather than any other substance. So in the Minnesota weather, it rots, it falls down, the paint falls off, sometimes somebody slides through an intersection and knocks off a corner of it. The fence has a really hard time. So I hope you can imagine these two houses side by side. One, nice older house, beat up white picket fence. Other, nice older house, beautiful, beautiful flower garden. Now, let's think about those two houses in terms of positive and negative externalities. If you come and you thought about buying the house from my parents or moving into the neighborhood, one of the things you would have to think about is, wow, I get to live next to these neighbors with this incredibly great flower garden. In other words, by putting all that money into the flower garden, they're providing a positive externality both to the neighborhood and to my family. On the other hand, you might say, well, I get to live next to the people with the flaking white picket fence that gets knocked down sometimes. And if you felt that way, you would say, well, that is, my parents are bringing a negative externality into the neighborhood, something that diminishes the appearance or diminishes the value. And other people have to suffer that negative externality by looking at the fence and dealing with it in those ways. So positive and negative externalities are just the same as we talked about in the previous lecture. This is an example which is just parallel to the example of hiring a band, that you can provide positive effects to others or negative effects to others that aren't directly paid for or aren't directly compensated. Because there are positive social benefits to innovation, positive social benefits to new technology, which are not received by the company, companies are going to do less innovation and less research than they otherwise would. The logic there is exactly the reverse of the logic that if you don't have to pay for your pollution, you'll do too much pollution. In this case, it's not a case of not having to pay for pollution and doing too much. It's a case of you're not being paid for it. You're not receiving enough benefit. And because you're not receiving enough benefit, you'll do less or too little innovation. The problem here, of course, then, for society as a whole, is to think about how can we make sure that innovators receive a greater benefit. So they'll do more research and development, they'll develop more newer ideas, and in the end, we'll all be better off from that new technology. The government has a variety of policy options, along with patent and copyright law, to try and assure that people who carry out research and development and people who do innovations can receive more benefit and thus have a greater incentive to carry out such innovations. Let me suggest some of the possibilities here. You'll notice, of course, that these are just sort of the opposite side of what we were talking about with regard to pollution. In the case of pollution, we were talking about imposing social costs on people so they would be more aware of the costs and more willing to do more in terms of fighting pollution. Here, we're trying to give them greater benefits so they'll have a greater incentive to provide research and development or new inventions. One obvious option is just to have direct government support for research and development. Government can just pay the bills. This happens especially in terms of basic technology, basic research and development, where no company can really afford, perhaps, to take the risks of making a truly basic scientific breakthrough. When we talk about basic technology, we're really talking about the kinds of things like a large center in a university for checking out particle physics or something like that. The costs of such basic research can be extremely high. And while the payoffs may be large, the payoffs are often something that the company itself can't really take advantage of. They may be payoffs that are down the road, years off in the future, as we get better understanding of fundamental principles of science. In that kind of setting, if you were running a company, you would be crazy to try and build some sort of facility like that. After all, if you try and build some facility like that, first of all, it's going to cost you a huge amount of money. There's no guarantee you'll get anything out of it. And even with no guarantee, it may be years and years before anything comes out of it, if anything does at all. So as a result, universities and sometimes private companies end up being paid and supported directly by the government in order to carry out research and development. One set of proposals now for research and development and encouraging basic research is to carry out more international cooperation, to divide up projects between universities in the United States and in Europe and in other places around the world so that we're not duplicating research being done other places. This, of course, requires a certain amount of cooperation, never the easiest thing to do, where we would agree to share the results of that information, even across national lines and between companies from different countries, as it's discovered. There's a lot of talk about doing this, but as you can imagine, it may be a little more difficult to do than to talk about. A second policy option, beyond direct government support for research and development, would be to offer tax credits or tax breaks to private companies which carry out research and development. For example, you might have a tax credit which would work this way. Take your total amount of research and development, figure out what 10% of that amount is, and 10% of that amount just comes off your tax bill. It's a tax credit for you.
Very roughly speaking, that's how a tax credit that was in place for research and development for the United States worked for some years. Many, many countries have a research and development tax credit. The big advantage of the tax credit is its flexibility. When you talk about direct government spending, then you also have direct government audits and control and, to some extent, direction of the kind of research which is going on. However, if you talk about a research and development tax credit, as long as it's research, and as long as you have some way of segregating off your research expenditures, you don't have to worry about what the company is doing. You don't have the government directing it, so it becomes a very flexible tool for letting the government, for letting firms seek out what they think are their best opportunities, and encouraging them to go ahead and seek out those opportunities. However, although the United States has had a research and development tax credit, it's a credit which seems to be flicking on and off, kind of like summer lightning. It comes for a year, it goes for a year. It comes back for 2 years, it goes away for a year. It comes back for a year, and at the moment I'm giving this lecture, doesn't happen to be in place right now. When you think about it, that's a crazy way to run a research and development policy. How do you expect companies to make long-term research and development plans, to commit to facilities and commit to plans, if the tax credit that's supporting them is sort of jumping here, jumping there, sometimes on, sometimes off again? If we're serious about increasing research and development, then we really need to think about putting that credit in place in a permanent kind of way. A third policy option that we could use to try and encourage various kinds of research and development and encourage people to get more money from them would be to encourage networking. There are a lot of proposals out there for private companies to be able to band together and pool their money and put research together. There's something called Semitech, where semiconductor companies come together. There's a group of battery makers, people who make electric batteries, which have come together to work on research and development. We can imagine a lot of different ways in which the government could encourage these things. It could give them direct support, or it could just encourage a lot of companies to come together and form these kinds of organizations. But I think the encouragement of networking can go beyond encouraging companies to get together. Encouraging networking, for example, by promoting the internet and helping a lot of communication happen between different people is clearly something that the government has tried to do. The internet was originally something that the Department of Defense set up to try and encourage communication between scientists. And that idea of encouraging communication between scientists so we can avoid duplication and spur the development of new ideas is clearly something that makes sense from the point of view of encouraging R&D and new technology. In fact, I sometimes think that the government should go well beyond this kind of networking and really make itself into a place where new information about new technologies is actively available. One of the things I discovered a few years ago about Japan's patent system is that in Japan, when you apply for a patent, the patent lays open, as they call it, for several years. What that means is, if you apply for the patent can be publicly inspected by anyone. You can just walk into the Japanese patent office and look at it. This is different from the U.S. system of patents, where when you apply for a patent, the patent is closed. No one gets to see it until after they make a decision about whether you get the patent in the first place. Then if you get the patent, then the patent is open for public inspection. But in Japan, the patents are open before the patent is granted. And the idea in Japan was to encourage people to go back and forth and use each other's ideas in a very rapid way, to encourage the spread of ideas, and to encourage them in such a way that you're not sort of wrapped up with one company tying up an idea and not telling anyone else about it. Now, I'm not saying the U.S. should adopt Japan's method of letting patents be open. What I'm suggesting is something even simpler than that. How about if the U.S. government translated all those patents from Japanese into English and made them available? Just to anyone. After all, I mean, they're publicly available now. Why not have the government take the lead in making them more available? And many steps where the government can encourage that kind of networking, encourage the spread of new ideas, encourage things to be available more quickly and more easily, it can certainly help the development of innovation. A final argument that often comes up when we talk about encouraging support for government research and development is to have stricter enforcement of laws about patents, stricter laws about intellectual property, and more ability to prevent things from spreading quite as easily as they do now. There's a lot of controversy about this among economists, and I guess what the controversy really comes down to is, do we really want patent laws to be a whole lot longer than they are now? Do we want copyright periods to be a whole lot longer than they are now? Some of the things which are coming up for copyright law now are things like some of the original Mickey Mouse characters and some of the Disney characters from back in the 30s. They've been tied up for a long time by copyright law, but in theory, they would be coming off of those laws and anyone would be able to make a Mickey Mouse or make a Mickey Mouse cartoon, sell Mickey Mouse stuff. Walt Disney, of course, the Walt Disney Corporation, is arguing that this would be wrong, that they have a right to these, they should be able to lock them up, they should be able to keep their limits one way or another. But when you think about that issue, it's not clear why they should. I mean, why should someone be able to tie up a character forever? There should be some limit on how long you're able to tie up a character that you create, just like there was some limit on how long the cartoonist Thomas Nast was able to tie up Santa Claus or Uncle Sam. He actually didn't even try to tie them up. This is in the old primitive days. But if some new cartoonist were to invent some character, Bart Simpson say, you can bet that they're going to try and hang on to the rights to that as long as possible. And the company which owned those rights will try and hang on to the rights as long as possible. At some point, however, things probably should pass into the common domain. There's no reason that they should be held forever. So when you think about patents, you think about, well, stopping people from using patents, stopping people from using copyright, expanding the periods of time, expanding the protections, you have to say, well, hang on a second here. There's a balance we're trying to draw. On one side, we're trying to reward the inventor, to be sure. We're trying to make sure they get some reward from their invention, some reward from their effort. That's right. That's absolutely true. But that's not our only goal. In fact, it's not our primary goal. Our primary goal is to make society as a whole better off. And to make society as a whole better off, what we're trying to do is provide more technology that's spread throughout society, that many people can use, that's available to many people. And so when you think about that overall goal, patents and so on are sort of a compromise. They help encourage the new technology, and then they prevent it from spreading. Before we go much further in tipping that balance toward preventing the new technologies, we might want to think about some of these other methods of subsidizing technology to encourage rather than trying to lock up technology and help particular firms make more money. When you look at the overall U.S. national picture in research and development, I find it deeply distressing. In fact, it seems to me one of the sort of hidden scandals of our time. If you look at research and development spending, you go back to about 1986, and you look at it in real dollars, that is, you adjust for the amount of inflation, you find that research and development spending in the U.S. really has not gone up very much at all in the last 10 years or so. It's been pretty darn close to flat. It's gone up a little bit, but really hardly at all. Moreover, out of that amount that the U.S. spends on research and development, about $200 billion a year now, in the United States, about 30% of that goes to research and development spending which is aimed at defense products and new weaponry and things like that. Now, I have nothing against that, as I believe in having a defense, and I believe that you should have some research and development, but it seems true that that sort of spending is not particularly helpful to the civilian sector. Now, there is, again, as you probably are aware, a long argument about this, a long argument about the extent to which, if you do defense spending, research and development, there are spillovers into civilian goods. And there are a lot of examples in the past, like the development of the semiconductor or the Internet I mentioned a moment ago, where things that were originally defense-based ended up being thriving civilian sectors later on. However, more recent thinking on the subject would tend to argue that actually, those spillovers are less and less than they once were. A lot of defense-related research and development spending now might work on something like, if there was a nuclear blast, how do we make sure that our computers aren't wiped out, or our computer memories aren't wiped out? Now, that's an important defense question, but it makes really very little difference to the civilian sector, and the discoveries you make there are not likely to be all that directly applicable. In fact, it often seems nowadays that the inventions are going in the other direction, that things are invented for consumer uses. They're invented for, say, laptop video games, and then they're used by people in the defense sector to create things for teaching people how to run tanks or run planes or run other kinds of equipment. And the spillovers these days seem to flow more from the civilian sector to the defense sector than the other way around. Other countries, of course, like Germany and Japan, have far smaller defense sectors than the United States. If you look at Germany, Japan, and the U.S. in terms of research and development spending, what you see is that all three countries spend very similar amounts of their gross domestic product on research and development. It's about 2.5%. However, out of the U.S., about a third of our 2.5% is going into the defense sector, whereas for Germany and Japan, essentially none is going into the defense sector. So if you sort of think about research and development that's aimed at civilian products, it's probably true that in Germany and Japan they're having a more intensive effort at those things than they are in the United States. Now, everyone says these days that this is the age of information, this is the age of technology, this is where we're headed into the future. I believe all those sorts of comments. I believe that we're in an age of technology. Clearly, it is not the way to preeminence in an age of technology to be trimming back on your research and development spending. It is not the way to try and be the head of the world in a knowledge-intensive era to come. We know that markets tend to underinvest in research and development because markets don't compensate firms for the positive externalities that they provide. We know that we need to adjust, but we aren't doing it. We aren't putting enough of those things in place. When you think about it, it really isn't a huge amount of money we're talking about here. If you think about overall research and development spending in the U.S. as being, say, $200 billion, and you think of 30% of that is going to defense, that means we're only spending about $140 billion. Now, $140 billion is, from some points of view, a great walking huge chunk of money. But if you think about the federal budget, which is close to $1.7 trillion, that is $1,700 billion, we could increase it a few billion for research and development and really barely see it in the overall totals. It would make a real significant difference if we could think about even increasing research and development spending by $10, $15, $20 billion over the next few years. Now, I should be clear here that when I'm talking about technology, what I'm really talking about is not just grandiose new inventions, like the invention of the laser or the invention of the telephone or the invention of the television. Technology can also be a small-time thing. My favorite example of small-time technology, I guess because I've lived with it over the years, is the example of the laser printer in my office where I run my economics journal. In that office, we bought a laser printer when we originally started up the office, and I remember that laser printer fondly from about 12, 13 years ago. It was enormous. It sat on top of an entire table. It was a very nice laser printer. It was made by Apple. It made very nice copies, but it was huge, and it was slow, and boy, was it expensive and hard to fix. It was a real effort to deal with that laser printer. Over time, then, we got some new laser printers. We now have a Hewlett-Packard laser printer. And over time, the laser printers still kept making these nice laser pictures. That didn't change. But the laser printers themselves kept getting smaller and smaller and cheaper and faster until now I have a laser printer at home, which was just not all that expensive. It makes copies on my own little computer at home. Now, that kind of improvement over time didn't happen because there was one massive new technology increase. It didn't happen because someone invented something like the laser. The basic technology of the laser printer had been there all along. But the fact that the cost came down, 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 the performance went up, 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 all of that is new technology developing over time. And that sort of gradual, steady improvement can be seen in product after product after product. If you doubt it, go look at an old car sometime. Not just for the style, which might be attractive, but look at basic things like the fit of the seats and the dashboard and where the dials are and how it feels in your hands and how it handles on the road. Think about the brakes and the emission system. Things just get so much better over time that it's almost unbelievable. The other thing to remember about technology as we think about investing and increasing our national research and development is that the investments in technology are often truly unpredictable. And it's their very unpredictability that makes the investing in them difficult. A well-known contemporary economist named Lawrence Summers wrote a few years ago, "In a world that's short of money, it's important to have new ideas. Research spawns ideas." To paraphrase Pascal, a famous old argument, if there is no God and I go to church on Sunday, I will have wasted some time. But if there is a God and I fail to go to church, the costs will be transcendentally higher. Presumably you go to hell. Summers writes, so too with the search for new ideas. the payoffs to success dwarf the consequences of failure. When you think about research and development, what you need to be thinking about is, yes, there will be a lot of blind alleys, there will be a lot of places we look that don't work out very well. But boy, those successes, you just got to stay in it for the sake of those successes. And there are any number of famous examples where the development of new technology didn't work out very much as expected. When the radio was first developed by Marconi, for example, it was thought of as being something for contacting from ship to shore, that it was for two-way contact. Because at the time, people said, well, yeah, we could have a radio which sent out a signal that lots of people received, but what would be the point? After all, people out there don't have radios, so they couldn't receive the signals anyway, and what would they listen to? The example at the time was, other than a Sunday sermon, what would a lot of people listen to all at once? What would be the point of broadcasting something? It was just literally unimaginable that broadcasting, as opposed to point-to-point broadcasting, was going to make sense. Another example is the invention of the laser by Bell Labs. When the people at Bell Labs invented the laser, they thought it was sort of a cute invention, but they didn't bother to take out a patent on it. Because they said, and they wrote at the time, what's the point? After all, a laser has nothing to do with telecommunications. At the time, they were right. A laser did have nothing to do with telecommunications. But the whole process of sending signals over fiber optic cable using lasers has made the laser central to telecommunications in the time since then. There are many other examples. For example, a lot of research in basic mathematics people thought had no applicability at all until they started seeing how it applied to various kinds of computer coding. My point is just in general that we need to spend a lot of money on research and development, not so much for the things we know about, but for the things we don't know about, for the connections we're not sure about, and for those things which are going to come up in the future that we never could have foreseen if we hadn't put the money in the first place. There's yet another category of positive externality, though, which can be thought of as a case of an extreme positive externality. The extreme positive externality is known as a public good. And public good is a term with a particular meaning to economists that we want to try and pin down. A public good can be thought of as the kind of situation where, instead of a case where some of the benefit is going to others, or some of the benefit is going to people who didn't pay for it, in the case of a public good, all of the benefit will go to people who didn't pay for it. Now, economists often define this by using two words which sound a little complicated, but I think do clarify the subject. They are non-depletability and non-excludability. Now, let's think about each of these in turn. Let's think about a private good, not a public good, but a private good. And for a simple example, something like a piece of pizza. If you're eating a piece of pizza, a private good, we would say that that piece of pizza is depletable. That is, if you eat it, there is less of it than there was before. Typically also, pieces of pizza are excludable, meaning if it's your piece of pizza, you can hang on to it and prevent other people from getting it unless they buy it from you. So private goods are depletable, they get used up, and they're excludable. Someone can own them and hang on to them. Public goods do not have these traits. With a public good, it does not get used up as more people have it, and it's very difficult to stop anyone from using it. Example, think about the good of national defense. Think about the good of our military and the protection that it provides. When a new baby is born, there doesn't use up any national defense. There's no less of it for me because a new child was born or because someone moves to this country. Also, it's very difficult to exclude anyone from national defense. If we're going to protect the borders of the United States, we can't say to someone in Kansas, well, you're not included. We're going to protect all the borders of the United States, but not your house. Once you've decided to protect the borders, you're protecting everything within them. And so you can't really shut people out in the same way. That's called a public good, because it's non-depletable and non-excludable. Some other examples of things that have this sort of characteristic of non-depletability, non-excludability, are things like police protection and fire protection. If you're protecting a town, you've got police protection, you've got law enforcement, that doesn't get used up because extra people come to town or visitors come to town. The fact that I'm being protected doesn't mean you are less protected in a direct kind of way. Also, once someone's in town and you've got law enforcement or you've got fire protection, it's very difficult then to say, well, you know, now you're going to not include this person. will protect these houses from burning, but not those houses. If the houses are side by side and intertwined, you have to protect the group or not protect anyone. Highways have a lot of the characteristic of a public good. When you're riding on a highway, at least if you're in a car, you really do not break down the highway very much. You don't use it up for others. And with many highways, at least unless we think about big toll road systems all over the country, it's going to be very difficult to think about excluding people from the highway system altogether. A final characteristic which some people say is a public good would be basic research and development, very basic development of new scientific ideas. Lots of people can use new ideas, and they don't get used up. I can use it, you can use it, the idea itself doesn't go away. And if it's really a fundamental way of changing how we think about certain kinds of science, it gets into people's brains, and you're not going to be able to say, well, you're not allowed to change your thinking about how basic science works. It just won't be excludable in that kind of way. Now let's think about public goods for a moment, and think about a market that's trying to provide these goods. Think about, for example, a market where we tried to sell everyone as much national defense as they wanted. Now, that's sort of a complicated idea if you think about it. Why exactly is it so complicated? I mean, we sell pizza, we sell sweaters, we sell a lot of things. Why can't we just sell national defense in the same way? Well, the difficulty that immediately arises is the difficulty of what economists call a free rider effect. And the free rider effect works this way. What happens when the people show up at your door with a little clipboard in their hand and they say to you, hey, how much national defense do you want to buy? Let us know and we'll invest that money. You know, give us your check and we'll invest it into the Department of Defense. The answer that people would tend to give would be this. Now let me think about this for a second. There's 250 million people in this country. I might be paying, you know, a couple hundred dollars, but my couple hundred dollars makes no difference one way or another. I mean, it buys one toilet seat. It does nothing in terms of our overall national defense because I'm just one person out of 250 million. So if I'm just one person and my contribution makes no difference, then I'm not going to bother to contribute. What I'll do instead is I'll hope a lot of other people contribute. And we'll have a good, strong, solid defense. But, you know, why don't I just save my money and free ride on all of their efforts? Also, you would say, you know, once they've invested, once they've put all their money into national defense, I'm going to be protected just as much as anybody else. Once you've protected the borders of the country, I'm just as protected as anyone else is. So I don't get anything extra for my money. Because it's non-depletable and non-excludable, I won't use it up, and I can't be excluded from using it. The result will tend to be that when you go out and you ask people, how much do you want to pay for defense? How much do you want to pay for a highway? If you ask them as individuals, you tend to get answers which are very low. You tend to get answers which are, I don't want to pay very much at all. On the other hand, if you go out and you say to a group of people, how much would you pay if everyone else paid the same amount? How much would you pay if everyone else were required to chip in? Then you get much different answers. Because now people say, hey, if I say that I'll pay a few hundred dollars and everyone else chips in a few hundred dollars, then I can see that that road will get built. I can see that police protection will get provided. I can see that fire protection will get provided. They can see that there's some image that the public good could actually be provided as part of their own agreement. So when we come together to buy public goods, like highways, like roads, different things like that, like police protection, like fire protection, we come together as a political unit where we require everyone to chip in. In a market, if you don't want to buy something, that's okay. That's your issue. Say, fine, you know, you don't want to go to that restaurant? Don't go to that restaurant. You don't want to buy that house? Fine, don't buy that house. It's private good. We're not worried about it. But with a public good, we need the force of society to come together and require people to contribute. Because if you don't require everyone to contribute, you'll have a free rider problem, very few people will contribute, and the public good will never get built. Now, I've talked about this as if the only way to do public goods is to some extent to go ahead and do a tax, where everyone chips in a tax for the same amount. I should soften that just a little bit, because even with public goods, there's a variety of different ways of providing them. Many people would argue, for example, that education, especially K through 12 education, is to a large extent something with big positive externalities. It may not be a pure public good because you could prevent people from coming to school if you wanted to, but education doesn't get used up as people get more of it. It's not very depletable. And say that we wanted to encourage it in one way or another. Well, one way of doing that, of course, is to bring everyone together and say, let's vote on what the property taxes are going to be, let's vote on what the income taxes are going to be, and then we'll all chip in the money for the schools. But another way of doing it would be to have some sort of voucher system or to have parents pay for schools directly in various ways. There are a variety of ways one could try and do that. So it doesn't always have to be a straight tax and then spend kind of approach. If we're thinking about building highways, we could think about having toll roads. We could think about having mass transit where people would pay fares. We can think of a variety of different possibilities. And in fact, some of those toll roads, some of those bus systems, some of that mass transit could be operated by private sector companies. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean that public goods have to be funded by taxes, built completely by the government, run completely by the government. It just means that as you think about those ideas of public goods, there's going to be some element of bringing together a lot of people and of bringing together a broad group. If you don't bring together a broad group politically or in some other way, it's just not going to happen. There are a variety of other positive externalities, public goods type of examples. I mentioned education a moment ago as one that's of some key importance. I mean, after all, education is something which has a lot to do with whether our society is equal, whether people can exercise a certain kind of independence, and also whether our economy grows because the skill level is going to be rising over time. We all benefit to a considerable extent from living in a country where the standard of education is quite high. I sometimes say to people, doesn't happen too often, but people who are sort of say, well, I made all my own money myself. You know, I earned all my own money myself. I made my money and I'm going to keep it. I earn it because I deserve it. I sort of say, well, yeah, you deserve a lot of it. There's no question about it. But try this for a moment. Try going off to, say, India and earning the same amount of money. You won't have changed. Your skills will be exactly the same. You have the same education, the same skills, the same background and everything you had before. So the difference is between being here and being in a very poor country is that you're surrounded by people with a high education. You're surrounded by people with a high income. And you benefit from being surrounded by them, just as they benefit from having you nearby. So with education and with a knowledgeable society, there's a lot of things flowing back and forth. People say that public health is something that often has a public good or a positive externality kind of thing. If you want to have a society where people are healthy, you want to have a society where everyone has to chip in certain ways. Where what's going to happen is I'm healthy partly because everyone living around me doesn't have infectious diseases. If I lived in a society where everyone around me was unhealthy, then I also would tend to be unhealthy. Job training is another example that's sometimes given. If a company pays to train some worker, and then that worker leaves, then the company doesn't get any benefit of that investment in training. That's quite difficult. So companies will tend not to invest in training if they believe that the worker is likely to go someplace else. Again, there's a positive externality involved. So when you think about all these positive externalities, technology, defense, roads, police and fire, highways, education, all of that stuff, you have to ask yourself sort of a fundamental question. How far does all this cut into our thinking about markets? A lot of these first few lectures were really focused on the idea of markets and how markets had certain kinds of gains, how private markets could work very well and were powerful forces of nature. Now I'm arguing that there are all these different categories where there is some element of the market not working particularly well. In this case, because it doesn't offer enough reward for doing some things that will be socially beneficial over time. And again, you can make an economist case here, if you're a liberal economist, for all sorts of interventions in the market, all sorts of subsidies going to technology and education and police and all those different areas. That's a perfectly reasonable economic case in theory. If, on the other hand, you have a more conservative political temperament, you might say, well, I buy some of this, but a lot of the time, we'd be better off taking a step back and letting people deal with these things on their own and not getting so involved in having the government try and intervene in every single tiny little thing that comes up. My overall points, again, to repeat points that have been coming up throughout these lectures but are always worth emphasizing one more time,
is that it is not economics itself which is conservative or liberal. It is not economics itself which is pro-pollution or pro-environment. It is not economics which is pro-technology or against technology. The tools of economics are a structure of thinking for how we approach these questions and how we think about improving our society in such a way as to make more people happy. It's always worth remembering when we think about either taxes and so on for pollution, or we think about subsidies being handed out for positive externalities, that even if the market isn't perfect, the government is certainly not perfect either. And when we start thinking about how these taxes are going to be imposed, how these benefits are going to be handed out, they won't be handed out by some perfect group of scholars who've worked out everything in detail and have a correct answer. They're going to be handed out by political committees and by the government. So when we think about intervening in the economy, it's relatively easy to come up with a theoretical case for doing so. It's easy to say, theoretically, there's a lot of positive and negative externalities, and we need to go in there and fix them up. But in the real world, the world we live in, we need to think to ourselves, well, maybe some things make sense in theory, but by the time you've put them through the political process, they may not always make quite as much sense in practice.